Welcome to Reseed, a podcast about repairing our relationship to nature. Reseed tells the stories of a regeneration. The people embracing repair, redesign, reuse, and reduction. The people who are uprooting the extractive status quo and rooting the future in justice, well-being, resilience, and care. This is a podcast for those of us who are reimagining our relationship to the natural world and to each other. I am Alice Irene Whitaker, the host of Reseed. Together, let's plant the seeds that transform us from being takers to caretakers. Welcome to the first episode of Reseed. Thank you for being here. Today I speak with Chuck Odenigbo, founding director of Future Ancestors and expert in climate justice, oceans, anti-racism, public health, and decolonization. Together we talk about reading books under trees as children, how health, culture, and climate intersect, our oceans, our ancestors, and really about redefining who belongs in the environmental movement.
Where do you hold power? Where do you hold strength? Where do you hold influence? And what can you do to change those legacies and change those power structures and ideally dismantle them if you're able to? And in doing all of that, you're doing your part.
As it is episode one, I'll introduce the podcast and myself, and then we'll begin our conversation. Reseed is a podcast about people who are repairing our relationship with nature and creating a world rooted in justice, well-being, and care. Guests may be farmers, builders, designers, artists, makers, or writers. Each episode will delve into their stories and how they meet the grief, fear, and despair of our moment with heartfelt, handmade solutions that are growing a world rooted in care. A bit about me. I am a writer and mother of three. I am an environmental communications leader and storyteller. Over 10 years ago, I founded and led Mother Nature Partnership, an organization that worked to improve access with marginalized women and girls while also reducing waste. I've had the privilege to be a communicator for organizations focused on gender equality, transformative systemic change, environmental action, and redesigning the economy. 3 years ago, I was exhausted and depleted living a commuter life outside a big city, and I decided to make the leap to move to a cabin in the woods where I now live with my family. The intersection of gender, justice, and environmental care is where I root my life's work. In my writing, I've spent the past few years working on a book about regeneration, care, and the circular economy. My research has led me to interview farmers, designers, repair cafe leaders, builders, and writers in their barns, eco-homes, studios, and fashion runways. When I feel defeated by ecological breakdown, their stories have moved me to tears and heartened me, and I now feel moved to share their stories here on Reseed. So with that introduction, let's now have our first conversation of many together. Chuck is proudly Franco-Albertan with a passion for interactions between culture, health, and the environment. Outside of his work with Future Ancestors, he is the co-founder of The Poison and the Apple, a bilingual nonprofit that seeks to diversify outdoor spaces and make nature truly for all. He is completing his PhD in medical geography. Chuck says he is your typical urbanite, in love with technology and fashion, all the while retaining a connection with nature and integrating green and blue spaces into his everyday. His vision is to reconnect humanity with nature in a way that accommodates modernity, sparking that green revolution without decimation of the present. Chuck is a contributing author to the book Voices of Change, 12 Visions for How to Solve the Climate Crisis. He's been celebrated on numerous top 30 under 30 lists, and you'll soon hear why. I hope you have a hot tea or a glass of wine and you're able to slow down and listen wherever you are. Here is my conversation with Chuck Odenigbo.
Hello, Chuck. How are you?
Hello, bonjour. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's so nice to see you. And I feel like I might end up laughing a lot in this interview.
I don't know why that is. I am such a serious person.
You bring so much joy. I've only known you briefly for the last couple of months. To anyone listening, Chuck and I met at World Circular Economy Forum and had the pleasure of moderating a session together. And Chuck had suggested, I thought jokingly, that we would wear bathrobes in our televised live session in front of thousands of people. And it was not a joke. And I dressed up in my fanciest secondhand dress, and Chuck wore a bathrobe and pulled it off. It worked.
I just want the audience to know it was a yukata from Japan. It was the moment to wear it. It was this beautiful, long, flowing black garment. Environmentalism would make it sexy.
There you go. That's how you have to bring people into the movement, right?
Absolutely.
I so appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. First, I wanted to start looking backwards, asking you about your childhood and what your relationship was like with the natural world when you were a kid.
Oh, such a deep question. I will say, I've always been drawn towards green spaces and nature. Always. But I've never been a very active kid. As far as I can remember, I like moving slowly. I like relaxing. I like doing activities that did not require a lot of physical effort or a lot of strenuous. I didn't like doing a lot of strenuous activities. So my most vivid images of when I was most content are when I'm sitting down underneath a tree reading a massive book. And every time I was in a nature space, I'd always have a book with me. I'd find a little niche, a little corner, settle myself down, make myself comfortable, open up the book, crack it open, and quite literally get lost in the world of adventures and words and magic and fairy tales.
You really brought me into a world there. I can feel it and see it. And I would think that you were just speaking to your audience with reading a book under a tree, because those are basically my two favorite things on this planet, trees and books. But I did read it online as well, so I know it's true. I understand that you're passionate about intersections, in particular around health and the environment and culture. I'd love to hear more about this. How does culture play into health and the environment, and how do they all intertwine?
I've always had the love of nature. Always. But it was only when I started getting older that I really sort of started feeling, I don't know if the right word to use is distanced from nature, but sort of almost this pull away from the environment, as if the environment was not for me or nature was not for me. This was based around multiple things. I remember very distinctly when I was in when I was a tween, so I was like 11, 12-ish. The school I was going to at the time was like, we're going to organize a camping trip. Who wants to go? And I had never been camping. So I was like, ooh. And you had to obviously get your parents' permission. So I go home, I ask my parents, I'm like, hey, I want to get permission to go camping. And my parents were like, no. If we wanted you to be sleeping underneath the stars and sleeping on the ground, we'd have left you in a village in Africa. Why on earth would you try and do that to yourself? Camping's not for us. That's a white person thing. So yeah, I had like moments like that. And then, you know, as I'm once again getting older and I hit university, my attraction for nature turned into an intellectual curiosity. So I ended up majoring in environmental science in my undergrad as one of my degrees. One of my other degrees was chemistry. And I found it truly fascinating, right? Environmental science is one of those topics that's covered by everything. I had to take a religion course and talked about the impacts that religion has on the environment. I had to take policy courses. I had to take a course in wild law, which is this idea that of giving nature the same rights as human beings. And so allowing a river to be able to sue a company if a company pollutes the river. And all of these really interesting concepts and these varying courses. it really just highlighted to me just how fascinating truly integrated nature is with every single thing that we do. Because I basically had to take a course in every department. There was a business and sustainability course. There was a philosophy and the environment course and a moral philosophy course and a sociology course. Right? I had to get this full almost spectrum of skills because of the major I'd picked. And I thought that was absolutely fascinating, absolutely interesting. Even though I was really in this environment, really in this environmentalism stage, and I was like loving everything I was learning. Once again, I still thought, oh, but being out there in nature, not really for me. The environmental movement, not for me. And the reason why I didn't think the environmental movement was for me, even though I love nature and I was so intellectually stimulated by the environment, was because the messaging at the time, and it's messaging that we still see today, but a little bit less so, was very white, and not white in the sense of just mainly white faces, but white in the sense of trying to erase every other way of being. Because for listeners who may not be aware, whiteness is not a cultural identity. You can be culturally British, you can be culturally Scottish, you can be culturally from Saskatchewan. You're not culturally white. Whiteness is a consolidation of power seeking to erase other identities as it absorbs people into whiteness. So back to the story. You know, when you look at a lot of environmental messaging from that time period, it's a lot of things like overpopulation is one of the causes of environmental issues. When in reality, that is inherently racist, actually, because when they talk about overpopulation, they never talk about Canada or the USA. No. Or Europe. They're talking about Africa. They're talking about South America. They're talking about parts of Asia. But then once again, if you look at the carbon footprint of each of people in each of these quote-unquote overpopulated countries, they are doing nothing to the climate. Absolutely nothing. And you look at the carbon footprint of one person up here in Canada, down there in the States, across the pond in Europe. If we all lived like we're living here, the planet would already be dead. So it's clearly not overpopulation. So you had messaging like that didn't sit right with me. And, you know, at that time period, I didn't have the words to articulate why it didn't sit right with me. I almost felt like that messaging was subtly targeting me, you know, in a negative way. That cannot be a slogan or a message. You've got, you know, Greenpeace and the WWF trying to like push for people to almost go backwards in time in terms of like let go of a couple of luxuries and, you know, live in a certain way and, you know, follow a certain lifestyle, which once again is not accessible to everyone financially, geographically. But in addition to all of that, even when it is accessible to people, it ignores the fact that A, it's stealing knowledge from other cultures without labeling and naming those cultures that it's learning these ideas from, which once again is erasing history. It's harmful for those cultures. It's, you know, colonizing that knowledge in the sense that we're not attributing the credit to the people who created that knowledge. But in addition to all of that, it is also ignoring that people, there's certain groups of people who are inherently harmed by some of those messages. So for example, going back to my parents not letting me go camping, we're seen as almost less evolved in terms of our humanity. As a method of trying to sort of cope with, not just cope with that, but sort of prove to the world that we're human, that we're civilized, we tend to be very highly urbanized, right? And so in Canada, for example, 94% of Black people live in highly urban centers, 94%. So Black people are the most urbanized population in Canada. We're also the least likely to be found in green spaces. And so messaging that's like, oh, go do more camping, go do more hiking, connect with nature in that very specific way that has been used as a tool of dehumanization is ignorant. So back to the story. So I wasn't involved in the environmental movement because I didn't think it was for me. And I didn't go into nature places because I didn't think that was for me, right? And then in third year university, I did a course on sustainability. And the prof was very avant-garde. This was one of those very hippie profs, for lack of a better wording. And so for our final exam, the prof was like, I want you to change the world. And at the time, I was modeling. I have a love of fashion. Alison Irene and I were just chatting about this love of fashion right before we started the recording. And at that time, I was modeling. And I wanted to bring that into my love of nature. And I was just like, you know what? Let me try and do something interesting. Let me try and do something authentic to me, because why not? And so I got a bunch of my model friends. I double-checked municipal bylaws first, by the way. Side note. We went to a public park in the morning, and we were all undressed, and we all had like computers and books and things with us. And I had a photographer take pictures of us, and I called it my green dream, this idea of reconnecting humanity with nature without decimating the present, i.e. without losing the modernity. Because once again, we're always sort of saying this is, now is the best time to be sort of a person of color, because for the last couple of centuries, you know, people of color have been persecuted for X, Y, Z reasons. And so while nothing is perfect today, it is still much better than it was sort of yesterday. And so I always avoid romanticizing the past in my environmentalism, which is something that you don't see a lot of environmentalists do, right? A lot of environmentalists are always like, oh my God, back in the good old days when kids were able to just walk to school and free play in nature. It's like, no, white boys were able to do that. White girls were told you're not allowed to run around and play. And kids of color were told, were scared of being lynched if they were out in nature playing. So really, you know, I don't like romanticizing a past that was not for people like me. And so I really wanted...
And erasing so many people's experiences, right?
Yes, exactly.
They're erased from it.
Absolutely. And so I wanted to sort of really value the present, but look to the future as like, we need to reconnect humanity with nature. And so it was an Adam and Eve style photo shoot, right? That whole idea of like Adam and Eve, one with nature, naked in the Garden of Eden, but like with computers and books and things that we consider modern. And so then I sent a collage of the photos to the United Nations because they were having the Rio Plus 20 conference in Brazil that year. So this was 2012. And the United Nations published naked photos of me on their website.
How many people can say that?
I know, right? now that I look back on it, I'm just like, my God, what was I thinking? But not only did they publish
me... Are the photos still available? That's the question.
The website was taken down because it was just a website for their conference. So the photos are available, but are the photos on the website... No. Can I send them to you?
So,
potentially.
So don't look for the link in the show notes is what you're saying.
Do not look for the
link in the show notes. Photos of Chuck on the UN website.
Don't worry. If I ever get into politics, I'm sure they'll surface again.
I think so.
But what was really cool is like, A, obviously I got an A on that project. But then the other piece, which was really exciting, is I also got named one of the top 25 environmentalists under 25 in Canada. And that hit me really hard because until then, it never occurred to me that there were other people that thought like me and other people would resonate with my messaging and that my voice was necessary in this, right? A voice that says something different other than have less babies and don't fly, right? That surprised me, but also empowered me because that was that motivation. That was that that clencher that brought me into the environmental movement is realizing that I'm not the only one who doesn't feel comfortable with the current messaging out there and that I can provide an alternative messaging that can reach people who the mainstream messaging is not reaching. So that accumulates into coming into this sort of intersectionality piece that we're talking about, where on one level, nature and the environment is integrated into everything, yet we as a society have tried to silo it out, right? Nature is important for human health. Nature is a key component of learning, right? We need to be able to learn what it means to be in our environment, you know, in sort of every facet of life, you know, food, right? So you've got all of these different elements of nature that are being siloed out to a sense that we almost feel like, oh yes, no, nature, that is these people's business. I work in X, Y, Z. I have nothing to do with the environment. And that's absolutely not true. I mean, when fashion and the environment are intimately linked, like everything and the environment are intimately linked. And then the other piece of it is we as human beings are incredibly complicated in terms of our identities. And the societies we've structured around place place expectations on those identities. So we often, in Canada, we often use the term racialized and marginalized people. In the US, the popular term to use is BIPOC. In the UK, they have a different term. But in Canada, we tend to use racialized and marginalized because it recognizes that you don't racialize yourself, but society racializes you. Society gives you a race, and then you deal with the implications of being the race that society has given to you. We talk about marginalization, where you are marginalized for a certain aspect of your identity that most of the time you probably cannot change. And we talk about socialization, right? So I identify as male, but I also say to people, I'm socialized as male, which means that the blind spots that men have, I have to actively work to overcome if I recognize it, because sometimes I won't recognize it because I've been socialized in that manner. And so that socialization also creates the barriers that sometimes I face as a man, where it's like, oh, boys don't do this, men don't do that, right? So I talk about that. I talk about normalization, things about my identity that are so normalized I don't think about because society calls them normal, you know, being cisgender, not being disabled. That's considered so normal that I forget those are elements of my identity and my experience in this world. Because if I were disabled or if I were transgender, my entire life experience, it would be incredibly different because that's not normalized in our society. All of these intersect in such interesting and diverse ways. And because they're so societally based, and this is why those words are important, racialized, marginalized, socialized, normalized. Because it's so society-based, it means they're also based on the land, because our societies are intimately tied to the lands that they are on. And so our relationship with the environment is also incredibly influenced by the society we're in. And the society we're in is very strongly influenced by the environment that surrounds us and the lands that we are on. And so it's these incredibly complicated sort of threads that I don't know if we've tried to simplify, we just simply tried to ignore. But oftentimes the mainstream environmental movement and mainstream environmental efforts try to sort of ignore these elements. And in doing so, they inherently harm people. They also ensure that the movement will not be successful, because if your movement is harming people, there's also an element of it which means it will never actually truly ever succeed.
Right. Well, and it tells people, you know, your experience of being marginalized, of being racialized, of being persecuted is not important enough to be a part of this environmental movement. It's this other environmental issue or climate change or whatever aspect we're looking at is more urgent than your, you know, than the issues you face on a daily basis as someone that is not normalized or that is racialized or marginalized by our society.
Oh, absolutely. So when I was in Haida Gwaii, learning about the oceans. And, you know, we went to Haida Gwaii to learn about the oceans from the Haida people. And this is a culture that's inherently centered around the ocean. And so it's a nice way to sort of integrate traditional ecological knowledge into what most of us are coming with, which is scientific understanding and knowledge of the ocean. And while I was in Haida Gwaii, learning about the ocean and growing in my knowledge and looking for ways to be an ocean advocate, right? So really sort of doing environmental work, I remember I was chatting with one of my colleagues there, who is a Francophone and white, and we're both chatting. And this lady who's driving the bus turns to me while driving this bus and says, "Speak English, we're in Canada." What really hits me with that is, A, I was not the first person to speak French, but I was the only Black person to speak French. And so she had somehow either tuned out or ignored all the white folks speaking French. Mm-hmm. Until I came and used my voice. And then when I came and used my voice, she felt brave enough to talk to me to then tell me to go back to wherever I come from. You know, that's just one experience. I mean, one of my other sort of major experiences is I used to work in the oil and gas sector in Alberta as an environmental scientist, where I'd go to oil and gas wells that have been drilled and do environmental site assessments. And so this is funny enough where the chemistry degree comes into play. But an environmental site assessment is different from an environmental impact assessment. With an environmental impact assessment, you do that before anything's happened to sort of evaluate what the land currently is like and how you can mitigate any environmental issues. With an environmental site assessment, you show up after everything's done to see what the damage has been and how you can reclaim that land. A lot of oil sites in Alberta are actually private land, private farmland, all that fun stuff. So whenever I was supposed to go to one of these sites that's on private farmland, my white boss would always come with me because he would be the person to go to people's doors, knock, do that, knock, 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 knock. And be like, hi, just want to let you know we're here to evaluate the environment, do an on-site assessment on the oil well that's in your property. I just wanted to let you know that it is a black person doing it. Please do not shoot him.
Oh my God.
And, you know, not only was I the youngest person in this company, but I was also the only black person. And this stressed me out because I felt like I was a burden. I was the only one who had to have his boss almost babysit him to make sure that he wasn't being shot. You know, I worked 60 to 70 hours a week instead of standard 40 to prove that it was worth having me on board, despite the added burden that I bring of my blackness. Or like in Haida Gwaii, my blackness is calling, being brought to attention when I'm just trying to do ocean work.
Right.
I don't get the option to put aside every other issue, social justice, racial justice, discrimination, whatever. I don't get the choice of putting aside all those other issues to focus on the climate. Because when I try and do that, and I've tried multiple times, somehow my race comes in as a barrier. My language comes in as a barrier. Something comes in and acts like a barrier for me being able to do that work.
And you're taking on extra work, these additional burdens, and then being told, no, you should focus more on this issue and put your humanity at the door, and we can care about that later.
Yep.
Right. And you mentioned something about this earlier too, but how, you know, this movement to repair the relationship with the natural world and to, you know, greet and meet and hopefully avert these crises that we face. We can't move it ahead without everyone and without repairing relationships to each other as well as to the planet. Separating them out is, you know, leading us nowhere. Like, we need to look at our relationships as a whole and the types of relationships we have. And something I'm really passionate about is care. So not segmenting out our care for the environment, which, as you pointed out, is intricately connected to everything, but also care for each other and that community care, instead of siloing everything out and seeing us as individuals, some who are more than and some that are less than.
Absolutely. And, you know, to even take it a step further, and just to also help the listeners visualize this, is we as human beings have a habit of personifying things, right? We, you know, you can name a pen Bob, break it in front of someone, and someone will cry because they're like, oh no, you killed Bob. It's one of our greatest strengths, and also, weirdly enough, one of our greatest weaknesses is that ability to empathize with anything and everything once we have humanized it. And so with nature, we've absolutely humanized nature, right? With nature, we use a lot of female terminology in English and in French to refer to the environment, right? It's always Mother Nature. It's always she and her pronouns. We always talk about life giver, and, you know, we really feminize the environment. We feminize the earth. We feminize nature. And so if we've done that, do we actually think it is in any way at all possible that a society that's struggling with gender parity will somehow miraculously be able to fully embrace and accept nature when we're struggling to fully embrace and accept the people that we use to personify nature in a society that's struggling to fully embrace indigenous folk, in a society that's struggling to fully respect black folk? Do we truly think we can get this exact same society to then respect the earth and fight for the earth when we won't respect and fight for the people who we have coded as the earth, the people who we use to represent the earth? So ecofeminism states that the relationship between human beings and the environment should be like the same relationship that a mother has with a child. The mother is not the child. The child is not the mother. But the mother's well-being is very strongly dependent on the child. The child's well-being is very strongly dependent on the mother. And so it's a symbiotic relationship. And so the mother does not need to say, I am you, to care about her child. But then also, in situations where parents do actually sort of try to equate themselves to their children, we see a lot of misery because the children aren't allowed to be themselves. It's a sort of almost reliving what a life that the parents wish they had lived, or something along those lines. And that is inherently harmful. and
versus existing for their own intrinsic value.
Exactly. Oof.
What you're saying resonates with me. In fact, that's part of the system, is to look down on women, to use brown and black people in a system and exploit them to further that system. Like, it's not just a coincidence. It's actually part of the design, so that we're disrespecting, devaluing, exploiting so much of our humanity, so many of our people, but then that allows this exploitative system to continue. It's part of the design.
Absolutely. And so it's obviously difficult to undo, because there's so many things involved in it, right? Like, something that isn't often talked about, for example, is linguistic justice. And so linguistic justice sort of speaks to this whole recognition that language dominance is inherently harmful. And so a lot of people who may be listening may be like, no, why is language dominance harmful? It's much better if we all speak the same language. It's easy to communicate, stuff like that, right? But the thing about language is, it's not just a tool of communication. It's a great tool of communication, but that's not just what language is. Language is a vehicle for culture. It's a vehicle for worldviews. And it's also a vehicle for knowledge production. What that effectively means is, when we only do things in one language, when we only produce knowledge in one language, when we only have certain conversations in one language, we have automatically constricted and limited the scope of the conversation and ability to come up with solutions that are interesting and innovative. So in the past, our societies were inherently multilingualistic, right? And so you had a lot of pidgins and creoles form. So a pidgin and a creole is basically when sort of two languages meet, or two or more languages meet. Each language group learns certain words from the other language group and mixes them in with their own words to create a mutually intelligible language that they can use to communicate with one another. Rather than one language dominating, you have a quasi-language form to sustain communication while allowing each group to maintain that sort of cultural and ethnic background, and also that worldview. What English did, and, you know, I'm saying English because we're in Canada, but this obviously happened with French and with Spanish and with Portuguese and many of those languages, a couple others, but in much smaller contexts, is it came around and said, no, everyone must speak this language. We're going to force this language upon everyone. So you have many countries, Canada included, where people were beaten, where people were killed for speaking a language that wasn't the colonial language. And you're back to this sort of like linguistic piece and the relationship with the environment. To use an example, there was this really interesting study done at Harvard. In the study, they mentioned how when we see things as animate, there's a part of our brain that lights up, that does not light up when we see something as inanimate. And in English, we use the term it for anything that we see as inanimate. And so when we're talking about trees, animals, and plants, we tend to use it. That on its own devalues nature and devalues the environment and promotes a certain worldview where human beings are above the environment, because we see human beings as animate and everything else as inanimate. It's harder to see nature as inanimate when you're using the same pronouns for nature that you use for people. And then to take it a step further, I've been recently learning Michif. One of the things that really stands out to me is the Michif language does not really use pronouns for I, which is wild. So when you're starting a sentence, in English, your sentence structure is subject, verb, object most of the time. In Michif, it is object, verb. Ta-da! Wow. No subject. So the language automatically humbles me because I can't talk about me. But then the other piece that's really interesting when it comes to talking about nature is these certain words, like you use the word awan and a'ana for what is, and the way the teacher described it is, whatever has a soul, you use awa and ana. Whatever does not have a soul, you use uta and anima to refer to them. So what's really fascinating is then the class was followed by a debate on what does and doesn't have a soul. So everyone was kind of in agreement that like trees and animals have souls. We're going to use awa for those. But like, what about rocks? And it's like, well, according to the Stony Nakoda teachings, like the mountains, the Rockies have souls. But then that's certainly Nakota teaching. Definitely to other people, it's like a rock is a rock. You know, what are we doing with a rock? But then someone else was like, my sash, because it's you know, the Michif is the language of the Métis and the Métis have a sash. So someone else was like, my sash like holds so much meaning and value for me that I think it has a soul. And it feels like, yeah, then you can use Awa for it. But then I don't see my sash as having a soul, so I'm going to use Uma for it. And so sort of just in this little mini description using three languages, we see just how each language brings such a different worldview. And then imagine each of these languages used in a discussion about nature.
And the language itself raises these questions, right?
Exactly.
And brings that worldview to the fore. Two pieces on language that stood out for me. One was a study I saw that mapped biodiversity and loss of language, and that if you map the two over each other, that places where language diversity goes down, often through colonization, you also see biodiversity going down with this correlation between the two. And the other one was Robin Wall Kimmerer speaking really beautifully around the word kin and using the word kin for, I think she was using the example of geese, you know, when you see a flock of geese and talking about them as kin. And that to me connects with what you were saying about the mother and child relationship. It's not saying we are the same and this animal only has value when it's the same as me or has some quote value, but you actually just can see it as separate but related to you and part of your family.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I have so many threads throughout what you've said that I want to pick up on. One is around outdoor spaces and belonging. I'm interested to hear more about what you're doing with engaging other young people in outdoor spaces and people that have been excluded from outdoor spaces. Can you tell me more about that and how a sense of belonging factors into that work?
Absolutely. People are more likely to care about nature and protect nature if they feel a personal connection with the environment. There's so many health benefits that come with being in nature, whether it is from the air we breathe, but there's studies that demonstrate that kids who have unstructured play in nature are less likely to engage in acts of bullying. There's studies that demonstrate that people who are in a workplace, if they go outside to eat their lunch, they come back a lot less stressed and a lot more productive for the afternoon session. The studies that show that communities that live by the ocean are a lot closer socially to one another because the ocean gives them this feeling of awe and this feeling of being small and insignificant. And so they're more likely to be kinder to their fellow human and form those social bonds than we see in inland communities. All these different benefits of nature. The problem then being, so many people don't have access to those benefits because nature has been used as a tool of harm to that community and may still be used today as a tool of harm to that community. You couple that with the fact that we've also branded nature, right? We've branded what it means to be outside in nature. Not only have we branded the faces we see in nature, but we've branded the activities that we're supposed to do in nature. So in 2016, I think it was 2016, 2016 or 2017, Mountain Equipment Co-op, the largest outdoor retailer in Canada, the most multicultural country in the world, got called out by a black hiker because she had never seen a person of color, not a black person, had never seen a person of color on Mech's website wearing Mech's clothing or in any of the documentaries or magazines that Mech releases. Never. And this isn't, you know, the late 2000s. This is, in once again, the most multicultural country in the world. So that on its own, you know, is what we call lack of invisible welcome signs. Invisible welcome signs are things that let people know that they're welcome without having to explicitly tell people that they're welcome. But then you couple that with then also the activities that we promoted for so many generations. You have to disconnect to go outdoors, which then has you lose an entire generation of young people because you've grown up with technology as part of our regular life. And so then the idea of disconnecting is something you do for a holiday. Like, oh, I'm going to disconnect for 2 weeks, which means you're not integrating nature into your daily life, but you'll maybe like go out once a year for 2 weeks and disconnect. The idea that to really truly like be in nature, you have to go camping. You have to go hiking. If you go camping or hiking, for example, not an easy thing to do. It's not intuitive. the equipment's expensive. And unless you did it as a child, you feel kind of dumb when you're trying to learn how to do it as an adult. And once again, the most multicultural country in the world, that is highly problematic. We didn't all grow up with access to the same kind of nature. We don't all grow up with those same skills, right? If your parents are coming in from Sudan, which is essentially a country surrounded by the Sahara Desert, it's essentially a desert country. What nature means to you is incredibly different than what nature is going to mean to you if you're born and raised in Canada. So if your parents are coming from Sudan, how are they going to take you hiking? First of all, when are they going to have the time to? Because they're now having to adapt a new language, new culture, new way of being, new societies, create social bonds, create links, all that fun stuff. So you're there, you're the child. You're not going to, your parents are not unfortunately going to be the people who are going to take you out into nature. They're not going to be the people who are going to be able to connect you to the environment. And so you're probably going to be the one to figure that connection out on your own, right? Because that's a burden that first-gen people have. That's one of the burdens that we tend to hold, or not necessarily born here, but comes here at a young age, is that we tend to have to be the ones to form our own bond with the environment in our new country, because this is the land that we know. And the land that our parents know, the land that our ancestors know, is not the same as this land. And so if you're told these are the only ways you can do it, well, then you're like, well, I guess nature's not for me. And you keep your distance. The notion of belonging is incredibly important.
And it goes back to that throwing up these barriers to entry and saying you can only participate in this if you follow certain rules, do it a certain way, already know the decided upon way in which you engage with nature or the land, and otherwise you're not welcome here.
That is exactly it. And I know people who would hear that and be like, okay, I guess this is just not for me. Take a step back. This is not my place. So why are we allowing other human beings to influence the way we interact with nature? And, you know, because we're social creatures, unfortunately we do impact one another, and it can be incredibly harmful and, you know, hurt someone's sense of belonging.
I have many more questions, but I'm going to ask one more. You are a founding director of Future Ancestors, which, as I understand it, is an Indigenous and Black-owned, youth-led professional services, social enterprise, and startup that advances climate justice and equity with the lens of anti-racism and ancestral accountability.
I'm so glad you read that, not me.
Reading that verbatim, right? I always like closing these conversations on the topic of ancestry and ancestors, both looking backwards at our ancestors and how they affect us, and also looking forward, so to our descendants and the type of ancestors that we want to be. I'd like to ask you about Future Ancestors and what it means to you, and also if there's anything in your own ancestry that has impacted you in this path that you've chosen.
This is an interesting question. You know, the Francophones that come before me, the Black folk that came before me, the Africans that came before me, all sort of influence the realities that I live in and what I feel are like my responsibilities moving forward. Because whenever I go through anything difficult, whenever I go through what I perceive to be a barrier, the thing that breaks my heart the most is not myself going through that barrier. Right. So it's like I've got all these like privileges that allow me to get over and break through a lot of barriers. The only thing that sort of breaks my heart when I'm breaking through a barrier is the idea that someone else who may not have the same levels of privileges that I have may have that same barrier come up, and that barrier would actually stop them. And that barrier would actually actively limit them in a way that they cannot get over. And that hurts my soul. And so I'm always trying to sort of change things for the future and change things for the future generation. And when I'm trying to change things for a future generation, I'm inherently making myself an ancestor to that future generation. I'm inherently saying that I am the ancestor looking over you, even though you're not here yet. And I hope that I'm making things better for you. We are the ancestors to the future generation, but we are also the future of our ancestors. And so while we recognize that our ancestors gave us so much strength, so much knowledge, so many teachings, cultures, foods, whatever it is, we also recognize that our ancestors made some mistakes, and it is up to us as their future to fix those mistakes such that the next generation no longer has to deal with the consequences of those mistakes. You know, it's not an easy thing to do. It's absolutely not an easy thing to do. And, you know, in our current society, we have this habit of being like, oh, that happened 10 years ago, that 20 years ago. That's, you know, my grandparents' generation. I have nothing to do with that. But in reality, we all have something to do with that, in the sense that, you know, if your great-grandparents owned slaves or your great-grandparents did nothing about the residential school system, let's say, you know, it's not your fault. You can't go back in time and control your great-grandparents. But you still benefit from it, in the sense that either you have wealth in your family that was passed down to you. And it doesn't even have to be wealth in the form of money. It can be wealth in the form of, oh, we inherited this house. It can be wealth in the form of, every generation of my family since whenever have been fully educated. And so I will not be the first of my generation to go to university, right? Wealth shows up in many different ways, but you're benefiting from that wealth. And so if you're benefiting from that wealth, then you have a responsibility, frankly, to make sure that the people who are harmed by that legacy can also benefit from your wealth in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, that can take many different forms. That can take many different formats. It can be through volunteering. It can be through donating money. It can be through donating land. It can be through sharing the mic. You know, like, really sort of making sure that you understand the privileges that you've been given. Turn those privileges into responsibilities, but then also don't turn those responsibilities into burdens, right? Don't put it along the lines of like yourself sacrificing yourself, but it's recognizing that our collective liberation is dependent on all of us, because there's very few people in our current society who have perfect power, right? Every single one of us tend to be marginalized or ostracized for one reason or another, in recognizing that upholding the power structures that oppress other people is also upholding the power structures that oppress you in some way, shape, or form, and that you may not feel actively now, but if push comes to shove, it will come to light. In recognizing that this system collectively oppresses, you know, when we do things to undo the mistakes of our ancestors, we're not just doing them for other people. We're not being Mother Teresa. We're not being some sort of kind, benevolent, like, gifter to the world. We're doing it for ourselves, because the same systems that oppress other people are the same systems that oppress us. And maybe they don't oppress us in ways that we recognize just yet. But if someone can suffer in the current society because of XYZ reason, you can too. When you look back on your ancestry, look back at all the things that make you proud of it, whether it is the food, whether it is your grandparents or great-grandparents or whoever came here with $10 in their pocket and they made it. You know, no matter what it is, feel that pride, feel that joy, you know, be proud of yourself. But don't turn a blind eye to the bad parts. You know, recognize the bad parts happen too. The bad parts absolutely did happen. And recognizing the bad parts happened, ask yourself, how do I benefit from these negative things that happened? Because people aren't often evil for the sake of being evil. Often they're evil for some sort of gain. So what did they gain from doing some of these bad things? And how do you benefit from these gains, even if it's not direct but indirect? And based off of all of that, where do you hold power? Where do you hold strength? Where do you hold influence? And what can you do to change those legacies and change those power structures, and ideally dismantle them if you're able to? And in doing all of that, you're doing your part. And if we all do our part, then even if things are very unlikely to be perfect, because we're inherently flawed as creatures, we're never going to be perfect, things will be better, and things will be more interesting, and things will be more fun and colorful and vibrant. And, you know, I think we owe it to the next generation to, like, leave them a world where things are more colorful, fun, and vibrant, right?
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Chuck. I hope you enjoyed it. If our conversation resonated with you, please subscribe, review, and share. For show notes and a transcription, or to tell me what you thought, visit reseed.ca. Reseed is created on unceded Algonquin land. Thank you to this place. Thank you to Rebecca Rivola for podcast cover art, and Tegan Akers for being an outside eye. And thank you for listening. Together, let's plant the seeds that transform us from being takers to caretakers.